Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I am your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Hello, Judy, and hello, listeners. We have a treat today. We have an interview with Susan and Bob Epstein. They've been married for 40 years, and they are life coaches and MBTI consultants. That's Myers-Briggs, if you've heard of that before. And we've already done the interview, and it was really just fascinating, and I think you're in for a treat listening to it. So this podcast, of course, is Couples Therapy in 7 Words. And wherever you got this podcast from, if you got it from my website, you don't have an opportunity to do this. But if you got it from iTunes or Spotify or Stitcher or any of the zillions of places you can find them, if you would please comment and give us a rating and like and share our posts on social media, and that will be a way for people to get the word. And we're really encouraged. There are more and more people each time. We're sort of growing virally, and we're hoping to grow virally again, not like the COVID that we want to go away, but our virally we want to increase. So we hope you'll share information about this podcast with your friends and everybody you know. And this podcast is based on the 7 words mentioned in the title, and the 7 words are:
be kind, don't panic, and have faith.
And that's the formula that my book, my recent book, is also based on. The name of the book is Reigniting the Spark: Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. And that's available anywhere books are sold. And so without further ado, we're going to move on to the interview. You'll first hear Judy introducing our guests, and then you'll hear the interview.
Our guests today are life coaches Susan and Bob Epstein. I've known Susan and Bob for decades, since Susan and I were in school together in Long Beach, New York. Here's how Susan describes their backgrounds. Ever since I was a child, I was interested in people and relationships and what made them work. Having a reflective and intuitive personality, one of my favorite things to do as a young teen was to read my mother's Ladies' Home Journal as soon as the mail carrier delivered it. I would eagerly analyze the segment, "Can This Marriage Be Saved?" which entailed reading his side, her side, and the therapist's side. I loved the different perspectives and would later use them for workshop exercises in my personality types class, which I taught to the faculty in my school district for 20 years. My background is in speech and theater from NYU, and in psychology, special education, and elementary education from Baruch College, with a master's degree in literacy from Queens College. I taught special education for 30 years in a Long Island school district. I am a certified professional life coach, MBTI personality types consultant. My coaching involves helping people to navigate personal and professional relationships, finding life partners, helping people understand themselves and others, and communicating more effectively. I also can assist with time management and career counseling. I have been married to my husband, Bob Epstein, since 1979, and he is also a certified professional life coach. We have 2 children and 4 grandchildren. Bob, also an intuitive, has a background in speech therapy and taught high school English for 39 years. He has both a bachelor's and a master's in English and speech education and a professional diploma in school administration and supervision from Brooklyn College. Susan and Bob, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Thank you so much. Hi, Judy and Bruce.
Nice to see you.
Hi, great to have you.
So nice to be here.
It's great to have you. I look forward to the time we can all get together again.
Yes, I'm excited.
Great. So why don't we just start right in? And I have a question for you right off the top after reading your bio. Okay. For our listeners who might not be familiar with MBTI, why don't you tell us all about it?
Okay, that's the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator. And it's based on Carl Jung's theories that people have inborn preferences. Therefore, their behavior is predictable. And Myers and Briggs, a mother and daughter team, came up with this indicator that clarified people's preferences And there are four sets of preferences, which if you'd like, I could go into. The first is introversion and extroversion. The second one is being a sensor intuitive. That's how you take in your information. The third one is how you make your judgments, which is thinker or feeler. And the last one, the last set of preferences is how you live your lifestyle. Do you live it in a spontaneous way, or do you prefer to live it in a more scheduled manner? That's the Myers-Briggs type indicator.
And you were saying that's really had its origins in Jungian,
yes.
A Jungian understanding of how people work.
Yes, in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you use the word preferences quite a bit, which I find really interesting. Can you say a little more about that? Like, what does it mean that what it's talking about is different ways that people have preferences and ways that operates in their relationships? I'm curious.
Yes. Oh, yes. Very, very big. Okay. So what I had forgotten to mention before with the introversion and extroversion, it's how you take in what energizes you. With introverts, it's ideas, thoughts, and feelings. It's more of your inner world. And with extroverts, it's the outer world of people, places, and things. And so that's just one of the preferences where it makes for interesting dynamics in any kind of match, be it platonic friendships or romantic relationships. And it definitely has its interesting combinations that results in certain dynamics.
And everyone has their natural proclivities towards those preferences, but no one's 100% one way or the other. Given situations, you may extrovert yourself if you're more of an introverted type, or vice versa. So nothing's 100% unless you're an extraordinarily extreme case.
Right, and there is a spectrum, of course. I call it the I and the E. There is a spectrum of the I, and there is a spectrum of the E, and there are also ambiverts, which kind of fall right in the middle, which are comfortable either way.
Yeah. You probably know this. I can't think of the name of the author. In the past several years, somebody wrote a really well-known book on introversion. And what they
Susan
were
Susan Cane. Susan
Thank
Cain.
You. That's the name. Yes. I figured you'd know it.
And, yes.
What stuck in my mind, it's funny, I haven't read the book, but I've certainly read about it, and what it comes up in my conversations with clients a fair amount, that the thing, the real differentiator, as I recall, and tell me if I'm remembering this correctly, is that idea of what energizes you. And I really related to that. I'm much more of an introvert, and Judy's much more of an extrovert. I don't think either one of us is 100% either way, but I know that sense that when they're I actually enjoy meeting people. I enjoy being with people. But for me, it's more apt to cost energy. And I think for Judy, and you can speak for yourself, but yep. I think for Judy, it's much more apt to energize her.
Yep.
She's drawn to it.
Very much so.
So those things certainly can play out in a relationship. If somebody between the two of us is going to be proposing going somewhere with people, it's going to be Judy proposing it the vast majority of the time. And it's going to be me. I've learned over the years, it's like, no, don't immediately say no. Because usually when I say yes, then I go and I have a good time. But it's this gearing up for it that I have to do because of my sort of natural proclivity toward introversion. And I think, Judy, for you, it's like you just naturally are drawn to it.
There was an interesting story because in my personality class, I always encouraged, I told my personal stories and opened myself up and was very vulnerable. And I encouraged people to share. They didn't have to share. And there was one interesting story of this particular teacher, very extroverted, who was married to an introvert. And she loved to go to parties. And the problem was he always wanted to leave early because she became more and more energized throughout the evening. And after a couple of hours, or maybe an hour, I don't know, a half hour, he was ready to go. He was
sounds like us.
Have you been watching us?
Yeah, probably. He got overstimulated. That's what happens to introverts because introverts are wired differently than extroverts. Mm-hmm. So they decided on this compromise where they actually took, if it was feasible, two separate cars. And she was permitted to stay as long as she wanted at this particular social gathering. And if he really felt that the energy was being sapped from him, he you know, took his car and left to go home. And it seemed to really, really work for them. Mm.
And for me, as a teacher for so many years, I had to extrovert myself in order to teach my classes. And yet many students would see me outside of school and they would say, hey, you know, you're kind of quiet, Mr. Epstein. We're used to you being more animated. And, you know, in my own mind, I'm saying, well, I have to be, you know, I have to use my non-preference.
Sure.
At that point. So, as I say, it is no 100%, and you do what you have to do given the situation in that regard.
Very much so. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your training as a life coach. I'm especially interested in how coaching is similar to and different from therapy.
Okay. So as life coaches, you're not really supposed to give advice. It's supposed to come from the person. You're supposed to ask the right questions. They do about 80% of the talking. You decide on the goals that they want to reach, and you're kind of guiding them in the direction of those mini goals. I believe in chunking. In life, we have to chunk because things can become overwhelming. As a special education teacher, we chunked information all the time. When you find out what your goal is or you dream what your goal is, sometimes it is such an overwhelming thought. So you say, well, what steps do I have to take to get there? And then they come up with various scenarios and ideas, and they have to do the work. And you have to kind of make a contract that they're going to be doing some of the work and reporting back and seeing, you know, the methods in which they're going to reach these goals. So The answers come from within them.
The coach is sort of a guide to their self-discovery. You know?
Yes.
You know, it's interesting because so far, everything you've said, I could easily apply to how I work as a therapist. There's very little, and I can't think of anything you just said that I wouldn't say also. I certainly try not to give advice in the sense of, you know, telling people how to live their lives. They know much better than I do how to live their lives. Mm-hmm. It needs to come from them, certainly, that idea that it's up to them to know what they're trying to achieve and be the ones to achieve it. And I'm there to ask them the right questions much more than to tell them what to do. So there is there's a fair amount of overlap. You know, I've always felt being a psychologist, and it maybe have something to do with my particular background that led me there, but I've always felt the sense that that's a label that doesn't really say much when you're actually with people. I have known people who have a variety of different kinds of training that seem to be really good at what I call therapy, or at least more broadly speaking, helping people. And it doesn't seem to matter much what your particular training is. It's much more about the relationship. Do you find that's true?
I agree with that. There has to be a compatibility between the helper and the one who needs the help. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I also think, Bruce, that you operate a little differently from what I'm hearing from other therapists. Because, you know, some of my friends that see therapists, they'll always say, well, my therapist said this. My therapist told me I have to do that. And from what you've told me, you don't do that. So it sounds more like what you're doing with what Bruce and what Bob and Susan are doing with more like ascertaining the proper questions and getting them to a point. Yes?
Yeah, there's a big variation among therapists. And of course, then there's the interesting phenomenon that, you know, I will hear people quoting their, when I'm doing couples work, I'll hear people quoting their individual therapist or occasionally their coaches, actually, either way, and saying what their therapist said. And every once in a while, somebody will tell me what I said to them that was either helpful or not. And of course, I want to hear either one. But it's especially funny with the ones that they found especially helpful, because lots of times people will tell me that I said this amazingly helpful thing and I will have no memory of saying it. And I don't think it's just my memory. I mean, in other words, I'll have said something that tweaked and they made it their own and it was incredibly meaningful to them. Uh-huh. And I wonder if some of the things you know, your friends are telling you, their therapists are saying, it's not so clear that their therapists were saying them. Look, sometimes they were. I mean, I've heard stuff from therapists that sometimes really shocks me. It's like, oh my God, you would say that to another human being? So right. I do have some issues with that. But there is a lot of variation in that.
It's interesting. A couple of weeks ago, we had two friends over socializing outdoors, right, by our pool. And one of the women said to Susan, she said, you know, you and Bob are really role models for a lot of us. And we were like, we are.
How are we role models?
So we're married for 41 years. And I guess that's a statement in itself. But then I guess there are other things that come into play where we're kind of easy with ourselves. We're good at hosting things and people see us in that light. And I guess we're somewhat educated and articulate. But it was like, really? You know, role models. You know?
Well, I can, of course, Judy is better equipped. Judy knows you much better than I do. But I can address a little of that just from my perspective, because it's not merely that you've been married for 40 years. I mean, I know lots of people have been married for 40 years who I wouldn't consider role models because they don't seem to enjoy it. And, you know, the two of you, when I've been with the two of you, you've been married for 40 years and you seem to like that fact. You know, that's, I think, for a lot of people, what makes people role models.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of fun together and we're best friends. We are absolutely best friends. And it's like, I look at it like every night is like a slumber party.
That's great.
We just have a good time together.
And what's mm-hmm. interesting is that, I mean, both of us taught for many years. And as we went through the system, there's a turnover of staff, of personnel. And as we got along in the years of teaching, there were many young teachers that came in who were single mm-hmm. and who naturally, the women would go to Susan for advice.
And a few of the men.
With their boyfriends and some uh-huh. of them, yeah. And was almost like pre-marriage counseling, you know, which I think which struck us very interestingly. Why not have the counseling before you're married? Because before the web gets tangled mm-hmm. and have to untangle it, try to, you know, prepare for what might come.
I've had actually a few broken engagements after my class.
That's a good thing. You know, in some ways, that's a good thing. That saves them from the pain later.
I
know that, you know, a lot of clergy people will do premarital counseling. So if you're going to a rabbi or a minister or a priest, they'll often do premarital counseling.
I've done a fair amount of that, actually. I say a fair amount. I mean, over the years, you know, in any given year, I'll maybe do one or two couples where that's what they'll be after. And it is interesting. I mean, sometimes they're there because there's some serious problem happening. That's why they sought out, you know, couples counseling. But often it's just that they've seen other folks have issues and maybe their parents have had issues and they're going into a marriage and they really want to go in on, you know, on as strong a footing as possible. And it's often been very helpful for folks to do that.
But, you know, it's interesting because as far as the premarital, I used to have these young women coming to me before any relationship. And I would ask them, well, what are you looking for? Mm-hmm. And they couldn't even tell me. They would start describing physical attributes. And I'd say, I'm not talking about physical attributes at all. I'm, you know, and they really had to articulate not only to me, but just to themselves. You have to kind of know what you want and what works for you in order to know what you're looking for and what could possibly work before you can even go out looking. That's why this Tinder thing with a swipe left or swipe mm-hmm. right and just going by looks, I don't know. I mean, I didn't even see Bob before I... But we were fixed up. It was a blind date. So I didn't even...
But I saw her.
Yeah, he did. He saw a picture of me. I did not see a picture of him. But all this with basing on, you know, physicality, I think people have to learn how to look for the right qualities and understand what are their important qualities. What do they like? What don't they like?
Yeah, I think that's so true that you really have to know what it is you're looking for.
I'm going to put in a plug for one of my favorite concepts here, actually, because we've touched on this quite a bit in our podcasts, that I think what we're one of many ways, of course, of looking at this, we're all after both stability and intimacy in mm-hmm. our relationships. And a lot of people are surprised to discover, sometimes unpleasantly surprised to discover once they get into a relationship, that those two important things require different skills and are even somewhat in opposition to each other. And so a lot of people will go into it. You know, it's interesting. I think that the generation younger than us, that, you know, the younger folks you were talking to, my note, maybe I'm sounding like an old geezer here, but I'm a card-carrying Medicare recipient, so I guess I can sound that way. what the younger generation of women, especially, I've noted, don't seem to be looking for as much of the stability stuff as they used to. You know, when I was a kid and growing up in high school, this sounds very old fashioned, but I think to impress a girl, you'd have to have prospects. You know what I mean? You'd have to be somebody that they look at and say, well, he could support a family. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger generation of women growing up in, you know, 80s, 90s and forward were so much more able to see themselves as being able to earn a living themselves, which I think is a good thing. But they would stop looking for that in young men. And so young men seem to be kind of cut adrift, not knowing what they're supposed to be doing. And, you know, you see this reflected in the statistics in who's showing up in the selective colleges. They have to lower their standards so they can get some men in, because it's women mostly who are the ones who are excelling in high school. And so there's a lot of that sense where I think women aren't looking to men. They're not insisting that men be able to show up in the ways that maybe at one time they would look for. I don't know. Does any of that make any sense?
And in that regard, I think that, you know, with women's liberation and their financial independence, I think you saw the divorce rate rise dramatically.
Yeah, there was a huge spike of that in the 70s. I think a lot of that was pent up demand, because people were stuck in really bad marriages before they liberalized the divorce laws.
Mm-hmm. And also because women had more opportunities to earn a living,
yeah,
which they didn't have in the past.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I want to also touch on something, Bruce, that you, because I'm reading your book right now, has a lot of wonderful concepts and tips in it. You said a lot about kindness in the book. And this is an interesting story. I was at my nail place, and Bob had called me on the phone, and I had this very short conversation with him. And my nail technician said to me, "You speak to your husband so nicely." Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Well, of course, this is the way I always speak to him." And she seemed to be really shocked what a nice conversation we had. She says, "I'm always yelling at my husband or short-tempered with him or nasty." And I thought that was a very valid point in your book about being kind. Mm-hmm. People don't realize their tone or, you know, not being kind to their significant other has a great impact on the relationship.
Absolutely. Yeah. The formula that this podcast is named after, the seven words, is be kind, don't panic, and have faith. And of course, it's all organized to get you to being kind, because the don't panic is so you can be kind, and have faith is so you don't panic. So it's so interesting and not at all surprising to me that your nail technician could hear that in a brief conversation. You know, just a brief conversation, you can hear how people think and feel about each other. And that has everything to do with a long-term relationship going well. You know, that feeds very well into, of course, it feeds into stability, because if you're generally treating each other well, you feel good. And that's going to be a stabilizing factor. And of course, it has a lot to do with intimacy as well, because the implication is if you're used to treating each other well, you're going to be willing to say stuff that may be a little bit anxiety producing. You know, if there's a disagreement or there's something you want to request differently, you're much more willing to do that if you're in the presence of someone that you're used to feeling kindness from and giving kindness to.
And it makes you feel safer too. The kindness engenders the safety factor.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I know you're both now retired, Bob. You've been retired for about 9 years, a little bit more. And Susan, you for about a year and a half.
Yeah, 9 years.
Yeah, year and a half for me.
So, you know, I know that sometimes when couples retire, they drive each other crazy. And you're now in a new phase in your relationship where you're together all the time. Mm-hmm. And you're also working together in this, life coaching arena. So how has that affected or changed your relationship, or has it changed your relationship? And how have things, how are things going with that?
Should I answer first? Oh, no, you want to answer? So, go ahead.
Well, it's interesting because with the pandemic affecting all of our lives, especially the first number of months when we were really quarantined and we weren't going anywhere, everything was being delivered. And so we were really confined.
We didn't step out of the house for 2 months.
Yeah, I know
that
feeling.
Confined to the house. So that could cause a lot of problems in a partnership, but we seem to have navigated a way of doing that quite naturally, whereby every room in our house has become a work room, a TV room, a social room. We seem to have, we call one of the rooms the hotel room.
You could have cut that one out.
No way. I think that's delightful, and that really speaks to intimacy.
So when Susan's going to work on something, she'll say, you know, I'm going to work. I'm going to the workroom, you know, and I said, okay, I'm going to the reading room.
I'll say, I'll see you in a couple of hours. And we pretend we're going out, but each room is a different, you know, it symbolizes something different for us.
Mm-hmm. So that's sweet.
And then we have a collaboration room where we're both writers, and we like to, you know, hear each other's writing and edit for each other and so forth. Yeah. So we work together too.
We have a lot of commonalities, a great deal of commonalities. This is crazy. We're both left-handed. We have the same birthday. We both love writing, acting, all different things. And we, you know, the same values. And we, thank goodness I married someone who enjoyed theater, because theater is my life. Yeah. And it's an interesting way we kind of, I feel you have to mimic the joys you had. So when I retired, we did a lot of theater. We belonged to TDF, and we were always jumping into the city, New York City, 52 minutes by the Long Island Railroad. So what can you do to mimic that? What I did is I went on Amazon and I ordered every Broadway show live that I could order. We also love concerts. Ordered all the singers, that the old singers we like to listen to, new singers we like to listen to, a Pink concert, Jim Croce, Elton John, whatever we like to listen to. And we have a big screen TV in our bedroom, and we'd say, okay, you want to see a show tonight? You want to go to a concert tonight? And I would even mimic, like during a concert, I would take little videos and pictures and send them to friends. And I actually was doing that on our 80-inch screen and taking the movies and the videos. And so you try to mimic as closely as you could your prior joys.
Mm-hmm. And now that we can entertain, socialize outdoors, we even order an outdoor movie screen with a projector.
We haven't used it yet, but
wow!
Oh, that sounds great.
We plan on using that.
We have to practice with that,
so we could show movies or concerts, DVDs.
Oh, nice! Yeah. That's wonderful.
Every once in a while, I think we all have our moments where we long for what it used to be. But I actually do not let myself go there that long. When I do start thinking about it, I'll indulge myself a few minutes, and I'll say, okay, we're not going there. You know, what do we have? What are the good things we have? And then I can kind of bounce right back.
Right. Because you have to go with what the reality is these days. And, you know, no sense pining. It's not going to change anything.
Oh, and another thing was, if I could just add, I think what was really important was to have a schedule. Even though we're kind of go with the flow people, I felt that bookending our days was important. We both love exercising. So I have a treadmill in the bedroom and I walk on that. Bob has a couple bicycles downstairs. He also likes walking outside. So we exercise for a couple hours. Each of us, we like morning. We're very much both morning people. And then do whatever else during the day, you know, whether it's phone calls, household chores. And then a lot of the evenings, especially with the first 2 months, we had FaceTime happy hours with various couples and various friends. So we enjoyed that. So it's kind of nice to bookend the days.
It's very interesting, because I do think that this current circumstances have brought people either closer together or farther apart. You know, it cannot really go any other way, because the truth of the matter is you're living in close quarters, and it's a 24/7 thing, or it was a 24/7 thing for several months. Mm-hmm. And for us, it's been good.
And we're both introverts. So I don't know. I kind of think we live in our inner worlds anyway. You know,
I think introverts have an advantage in this situation.
Just for our listeners, I want to put a date on when we're recording this. We're recording this in the middle of August in 2020. And so if you're listening to this some later time, you know how the whole pandemic thing has turned out, perhaps, but we don't. So we're
no,
right
we
in
don't.
The thick of it.
We're dying to know.
So I have, I want to bring to you one of our listener questions, and this one we think is right up your alley. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Ben writes, my wife and I have been together for over 20 years. We have a few sore points between us, especially in the intimacy department, but for the most part get along fine. The company where she works recently had all of their employees do the Myers-Briggs, with the idea of putting together project teams that will work together more effectively. She found it really interesting. Now she wants me to do it. She says it will help our marriage. Mm-hmm. Dr. Chalmer, I'm a private person, and I don't want some test telling me who I am. I don't like the idea of my wife thinking she can psych me out with the results, and I worry that she might look at the results and decide we're hopelessly incompatible. I suppose I worry about that too. But I don't want to be a jerk about it either. If it can actually help our marriage, I'd be willing to give it a try. My question is, how could a test like that possibly help us? Oh. So now we have the experts here.
Okay, should I go? Go ahead.
So what advice would you have for Ben?
Okay, I think Ben should definitely do it, because it, first of all, it will let him self-reflect and allow him to know himself better and mm-hmm. allow him to be more tuned into his reactions, not only to his wife, but to life in general. So if he recognizes, you know, the introversion, extroversion, he can maybe understand or have more clarity towards certain aspects of their relationship. But an interesting thing is the second one, which I wanted to talk about, which is how you take in your information, whether you're a sensor or an intuitive. A sensor takes it in, they're very concrete, very step by step. They work kind of from the bottom up, where an intuitive is big picture and works from the top down.
I mean, I think you said in your bio, you're both intuitives. Is that right?
Yes, we happen to both be intuitives. Now, if you're taking in your information differently, this can cause significant miscommunication. Mm-hmm. And I think, they seem to love each other and want to work things out. So if they're tuned into this miscommunication, they have to understand there are certain methods that they can look into. Let's say he's an intuitive and she's a sensor. So he can figure out, well, how do I communicate with my wife, who is a sensor and needs concrete verbiage mm-hmm. and concrete information. I think actually the second category of preferences is the most important when matching up people, because if you're taking in your information in two different manners, it can cause a lot of conflict.
Yeah, I see that in couples therapy. I see that a lot, where it mm-hmm. sometimes seems like part of my role is to actually translate between the two different languages they're speaking. Where somebody, you know, the kind of stereotypical example of this is an engineer married to a poet, you know, and usually the engineer's male and the poet's female, although I've actually seen it the other way around on occasion.
Wait a minute, the engineer and the poet, if I may just say, usually would both be intuitives.
That's interesting. So I guess I don't really understand the categories then. So help me understand that.
Well, I'm going to clarify. The poet, probably, I'm guessing here, I'm inferring here, that, okay, the third category is how you make your judgments. So do you think more, I'm just making it very in plain language now, mm-hmm. with your head or with your heart?
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, nobody thinks 100% with either one. We all use both, but mm-hmm. primarily. So that's thinker-feeler. The engineer is usually a T or a thinker.
Yeah.
And the poet is usually more of a feeler.
Yeah, that may be the category that I'm more focused on.
I think that's what you're probably focusing on, because I would believe in most cases, engineers and poets, in most cases, are both intuitives. And I think it's the T and the F dynamic. And what's very interesting, is when you're communicating with people, and this goes for friendships, This happens to go on your job. Let's say I'm communicating with a T. I'm an F. I happen to be a feeler, which means I make a lot of decisions based on my heart, my emotions. So let's say I'm trying to discuss a situation with somebody who is a T or a thinker who thinks very logically, clearly, more cut and dry. If I spoke in emotional language, it might not reach the person. I have to think about communicating to them in more cut and dry language.
Yeah. They sometimes, I've noted, sometimes don't, almost literally don't understand the words. You know, that, I mean, they, and I'm talking about two native speakers of English. You know, they're speaking the same language in theory, but they're really not. And
exactly.
It is fascinating. You know, this also, and maybe you can tell me how this maps onto the Myers-Briggs classifications, mm-hmm. but that phenomenon, you know, the sort of, and again, a stereotypical one where men want to fix everything and women just want to be heard, do you know? And I often find myself translating for men. It's like when she's saying, I don't need you to fix this. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we as men don't even know what to do with that. You know, so we're sitting there thinking, well, then why am I listening or what am I supposed to do? Or, you know, they'll feel very anxious about it. And I'll sometimes explain there is a problem to fix here, but it's not the one you think. In other words, if she's saying she had a bad day at work and is having difficulties with coworkers or whatever it might be, she doesn't need you to step in there and make suggestions for how to handle her work relationships better and mm-hmm. mansplain to her how to live her life. It's typically what she needs. And here I am mansplaining to the couple of women in the conversation. But, you know, usually what I'm telling this to the men, though, you know, usually what she needs is there is a problem. Again, from in male terms, there's a problem to fix. The problem is she needs empathy from you. She needs to know you care. She needs to know
I
that she's
agree.
Not in this alone.
So, well, you know, the question that the guest posed was that very struck me in this way. And I'm speaking in general or stereotypical terms, in that many men that I grew up with and have had associations with, they don't like showing their vulnerabilities.
Oh, yeah.
And perhaps, you know, an MBTI test would show vulnerability because it's really looking at yourself in an honest way. And I find that even with my own communications in life, I think I hit it off better with women because they're more apt to show their vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. They wear their emotions mm-hmm. more so on their sleeves, whereas men are much more cautious and reserved about that.
Bob mm-hmm. definitely has that feminine side. It's what I liked about him. He has the T and the F, which I consider him actually an X in that category. He's kind of in the middle of the mm-hmm. T and the F, but he understands both. But it is very important to communicate, even though you're speaking the same language, whether it be English, Spanish, French, it's not the same language of your preferences.
Yeah, and I think when Ben says he's afraid that he'll find out that they're hopelessly incompatible, if somebody on the Myers-Briggs doesn't exhibit the same compatibility, it's not saying that you're not compatible necessarily, but you have to find a different way to communicate. Am I getting
yes.
that right?
Yes, yes, okay. You are. If there is love there mm-hmm. and there is a foundation, I believe that relationships should be mostly good. I believe mm-hmm. that if you have to compromise too much or work too hard, you really need to reevaluate the relationship because if you can't be yourself at all, mm-hmm. I'm a big mm-hmm. believer in the authentic self. But if there's a good foundation and there's love and you have the same dreams and goals and values, there are definitely ways that you could work on it. And the first step is to understand it. So
well,
I don't
of
think
course.
He should
yeah.
feel threatened. I definitely think he should go for it and let him get to know himself more. I mean,
yeah,
that's the first thing.
The thing I would put in sort of the flip side of the same coin, actually, in a sense, it mm-hmm. could also turn out that the process of reflection that he goes through mm-hmm. as he does this, and similarly for his wife, they could conclude, you know, there is danger there. They could conclude that they're not compatible. They can conclude that, wow, we're two good people, but we're mm-hmm. just not working. And that's not because they took the Myers-Briggs that will make that happen. You see what I mean? That's, you know, his taking the Myers-Briggs feels dangerous, perhaps because he thinks it's like magic and it'll tell him stuff he doesn't already know. It will help him clarify some stuff he hasn't already clarified.
Exactly.
But it's not going to change the situation in the sense that, uh-oh, everything was fine until we did the Myers-Briggs.
Right.
If the Myers-Briggs breaks
exactly.
them up, it's, then everything wasn't fine, clearly.
Right.
And I think it's impossible to find 100% compatibility in personality types too. I mean, it's just not everybody's mm-hmm. going to hit
well
the same
exactly
notes.
And of course what we're after in other people is not clones anyway. You know, we want people who complement us, not people who simply replicate us.
You know, it's really funny. I find with some couples, it's very good when they have similar preferences. And other times, it can really work against each other. For instance, if you have two types that are very, very strong leaders and very strong ideas, and they both kind of want the limelight, that can be kind of a bit mm-hmm. of a battle there. So some combinations present more difficulties than others to navigate mm-hmm. and negotiate.
So Ben, I think what we're telling you is take your wife's advice and take the Myers-Briggs and see where it
sounds
leads
good.
To your communication and it's, self-reflection.
Have courage.
Have courage, exactly.
Give it a shot, right.
That's right. Absolutely. You should do it. Go for it.
Great. Well, thank you both so much. This was great.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm just so thrilled that we were able to get you. So.
Yeah, thank you for doing this.
We're thrilled to be here.
Great.
We appreciate it.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as we enjoyed doing it. As we mentioned earlier, Bob and Susan are old friends of mine, and especially Susan. We went to school together, so it was a real treat. And I have met Bob through Susan, and wonderful couple.
And I've met them through you, and I enjoy them too. They're great folks, and really hope you enjoyed that interview.
Mm-hmm. So if you have a question that you'd like to ask us on an upcoming episode, please email us at bruce@brucechalmer.com or visit brucechalmer.com.
And when you visit brucechalmer.com, if you go to the podcast tab, you will see, in addition to being able to hear all of our episodes up to date, you'll also see we're looking for suggestions for guests to interview on upcoming episodes. And that, of course, could be yourself. If you want to suggest yourself, that's fine. You can do that by email, or you'll see right there on the podcast tab, there is a link that will take you to a scheduler, and you can actually pick out a time to be interviewed. And part of that will ask you what you'd like to be interviewed about. And that's how we'll know if you'd be a good fit for the program. So, Judy, tell us about what our next program is going to be.
On our next program, we will continue our exploration of faith from our 7-word formula.
And I think I've mentioned before, faith is really kind of the distinguishing feature, more than other things, of my book on relationships. I'm sure you realize there's lots of good books of relationships out there, but mine in particular focuses on how important faith is in a relationship. So we will be talking about that in our next episode. As I mentioned earlier, the 7-word formula is what the book is based on, and the book that I've referred to is Reigniting the Spark: Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. It's available in paperback, it's available on Kindle, it's available as an audiobook as well, and I hope you will get the book and tell your friends about it. I've been getting lots of really nice feedback about it, and I really do enjoy hearing about it. We would also invite you to spread the word about our podcast by commenting and rating and liking and sharing our posts on social media so that people get to hear more about the podcast as well. And so, until next time,
remember, be kind,
don't panic,
and have faith.